Hello, and welcome back to another episode of Sharp China. I'm Andrew Sharp, and on the other line, back from vacation, Bill Bishop. Bill, how you doing?
I'm doing great, Andrew. Hi, everybody. It's nice to be back, though. It was nice to be on vacation.
Yes. Well, and it's rainy and cold in Washington, D.C., so we're going to have to put the spring celebrations on hold for a couple
but
days
it's
here.
Great. It's great rain for the garden. So
that's
I'm
true.
Looking forward to when the sun comes out and everything explodes in the garden.
I can't wait till we launch our parallel gardening podcast here on
Sharp Gardening. Gardening.
I'm ready. Although actually, I'm not ready at all. I have a lot of work to do before we do that one. But it is good to be inside podcasting on a day like today.
And yes,
we're outside the paywall this week. So a reminder to everyone that if you enjoy Sharp China, you can get access to weekly episodes of this podcast by subscribing to either Cynicism, which is Bill's daily newsletter, or Stratechery, which gives you access to several podcasts from me and daily writing from my friend Ben Thompson. Both are indispensable resources as far as I'm concerned. So subscribe to both, but welcome if this is your first time listening to Sharp China. And Bill, we've got a lot of material to work through because we were off last week. We'll start with a note from the big man himself. As Xi Jinping has always said, strategic understanding is the first button that has to be fastened in U.S.-China relations. And there was a call between President Xi and President Biden on Tuesday. That conversation had been telegraphed for the past couple of months here, but we didn't know it was happening this week. The White House said the call lasted 105 minutes. What are some of the takeaways you had from the messaging we got after this call?
So the call had been expected. Again, timing was unclear, but it was sometime in the sort of early spring, I think is what had been telegraphed. So it makes sense. And then we have the Secretary of Treasury heading off today to China, and then the Secretary of State is going, I think, by the end of the month. So this is all part of the continuing follow-up from the San Francisco, the Woodside Summit in San Francisco in November between Xi and Biden. I mean, this particular readout, or both readouts, you know, each side issues their own readout. They don't, at least these two administrations, they don't really coordinate it. So if you actually read the U.S. readout and the PRC readout, you might kind of think they had a different phone call.
Right.
But I mean, that's not the first time it's happened. I think what stood out in the readouts really were on the Chinese side, you know, Xi talking about sort of stabilization of China's relationship. He noted that the relationship is beginning to stabilize, but that there are still negative factors have also been growing. And that requires attention from both sides. And then he talks in a paragraph. It's broken out in the English translation, but in the Chinese readout, it's one paragraph. He talks about Taiwan and also the trade and technology suppression measures in the same paragraph, which I think is a sign. Taiwan is always the number one sort of reddest of red line issues. But this, I think, is in some ways an elevation of how much they are concerned about current and potential future trade and technology, what they call suppression measures or technology controls, actions, trade actions from the U.S. side.
Right. It sounds like it's trending toward a red line type issue for China. And the language from the PRC readout was pretty striking. They said the U.S. has continuously imposed trade and technology suppression measures against China, and the list of sanctioned Chinese companies is growing longer. This is not de-risking, but creating risks. If the U.S. side is willing to carry out mutually beneficial cooperation and share the dividends of China's development, China's door is always open. If the U.S. side insists on suppressing China's high-tech development and depriving China of its legitimate right to development, we will not stand by. And so the language about creating risks and not standing by feels a bit ominous. Who knows exactly what that means? But yeah, having it appear hand in hand with the Taiwan language that appears in basically every readout certainly feels notable.
No, I think it is. I also think the Chinese are right to be concerned about incoming actions around technology and potentially around trade. And that I think will also be something that's discussed on Yellen's visit these coming few days. Overall, you know, again, it's we're back to they met in November. They sort of stabilized the relationship, started an increased tempo of meetings and discussions. But none of the structural issues that are driving the relationship towards a more fraught and friction filled period, none of those have been resolved, and there really is no there is no I think indication it will be resolved. I mean, one of the things the Chinese side keeps pushing on, the issue of strategic understanding or the correct perception of U.S.-China relations, and from the Chinese perspective, and we've heard it multiple times in the last week, the idea is the U.S. has a fundamentally wrong perception of China and its rise in the U.S.-China relationship, and until that can be fixed and changed, that the relationship is going to be very difficult. Mm-hmm. And again, I just don't think from the Chinese perspective, of course, they want the U.S. to not see the rise of China as any sort of a threat, you know, not to see any reason to not just let the PRC side do what it wants with Taiwan and the South China Sea. That, of course, is impossible from the Washington, from the D.C. perspective. Right. I mean, it's just politically impossible. There are other reasons, too. But even if you said, yeah, we should just change our perception, it's not possible in U.S. domestic politics. And so, again, the Chinese keep saying this, change your perception, you know, and they're using the various tools they like to use, all the people-to-people stuff, the meetings with big dignitaries, the meeting she had last week at a meeting with a bunch of visiting CEOs and strategic leading lights, et cetera. And, you know, it's a similar kind of messaging, and then also wraps it around more and more people-to-people exchanges, more dialogue. You know, that's, I think, the best ideas the Chinese side has, and it's not going to fix the problem. But right. At least it's going to keep the two sides talking.
Well,
potentially.
And as far as PRC behavior in the Pacific, it's not just about the attitudes in Washington. It's the attitudes in Manila, the attitudes in Tokyo, and the U.S. presence in those allied countries.
Yes.
Or Australia. And so the domestic politics are also international politics for the U.S. side. And the existential issues, I mean, because China is currently trying to compensate for weak domestic demand by pouring resources into more and more exports, and it's creating trade tensions all over the world. And if you're the American side, it does really speak to just structural tension that isn't going to go away, no matter how cordial or candid. Candid was a big buzzword that was emerging from this call with Xi on Tuesday. And then, of course, there's also the technology side, where the U.S. is meeting with allies as we speak, trying to tighten some of the restrictions on semiconductor technology and paper over some of the holes that we've seen over the last couple of years with that policy. And so, yeah, it just speaks to how complex any of this is going to be in terms of stabilizing the relationship and at least putting a floor under things, because there are these wedge issues that continue to emerge basically every month.
Right.
Between the U.S. and China.
And I think also when you look at sort of the Chinese readout in particular, you know, it reads to me like it's sort of impatient, but it's also the Chinese side trying to be, I mean, both sides here are signaling to other countries and to their domestic constituents. And, you know, on the international side, it's signaling like we're trying to be responsible. We're trying to manage this relationship. You know, the other guy's the problem. Right. Mm-hmm. It's sort of what effectively sort of they're kind of both parties are really saying in some way. But then also, I think from Xi's perspective, the sort of reporting, the propaganda around his meeting last week with the CEOs and strategic thinkers, and then the Biden meeting, it just, he's a statesman. Right. It is important that they it sort of helps with confidence, because one of the things they're trying to do is they have a real confidence. They have a confidence in the domestic economy. They have a confidence issue among foreign investors and foreign businesses. And so, and one of the many factors that are driving, I think, the confidence problems are the decline in the U.S.-China relationship. So the Chinese side, I think, really understands that. And now they're trying at least to signal or make it look like they're responsibly managing the relationship and that things are calming down and stabilizing. And so that, what I think they hope will then help improve confidence.
Mm-hmm.
We'll see.
Right. Do you think the Chinese side does see the tech sanctions and the potential for even higher tariffs as an existential concern that could prompt some sort of conflict? I mean, along the lines of a Taiwan situation?
I mean, I think it's a spectrum. And so it's not like a sort of a binary, like do more tech stuff and then conflict. I think the current tech controls especially are causing some pain. You know, if you listen to the propaganda, you know, it's actually great. They're becoming self-reliant. They're making all these breakthroughs. And so you kind of wonder if the one hand, they're like, this is great in rallying the whole of society approach to breaking through all the, you know, American, especially technological choke points. And so this is spurred and accelerated those efforts of self-reliance that have been underway for decades, at least sort of the parties talked about it. You know, you'd think that they'd be happy with these controls, right? Because then it's ultimately you get to this great, you're no longer relying on foreign technology.
Sure.
Obviously, they're not there. They're very far from that. And so you can just see, I think, the way they're elevating the issue that, especially around the chips, is that something that is increasingly causing a lot of pain. I mean, one of the other things was interesting. Politico had a story yesterday. The Dutch prime minister was in Beijing last week. And of course, you know, ASML is a Netherlands company. And according to the Politico Europe, the reporter from Europe report, they said that the premier Li Qiang was asking the prime minister, what did it say exactly, whether the Dutch would be willing to keep servicing existing machines being sold to China.
Right.
Because I think they're very worried that these machines, once they lose service, you know, then it's much harder for the Chinese to keep them running. And then, of course, the U.S. side has been talking about pushing folks like ASML to stop servicing these machines.
Totally. Well, and China anticipated sanctions and was buying up a huge amount of both ASML and all sorts of chip making equipment in the years that preceded the sanctions of a couple years ago. And so if that equipment can't be serviced, then that's a problem going forward.
Yeah, no, the Chinese have been stockpiling whatever they can stockpile. And so I think the other thing that's at some point you're going to see in the ones that are public, I think some of their revenue is going to fall from China, especially going to fall off a cliff because like massive amounts of demand have been pulled forward.
Sure, exactly.
And they probably have bought more than they actually need or what will ultimately use and certain levels.
Yeah. Well, Ben Thompson wrote about that over the like 2018, 2019.
Right.
Everything was inflated because of that. Well, elsewhere in the call, she also raised the TikTok issue, which that was from a U.S. official.
Biden raised it, or she? I guess we're unclear. The background says they talked about TikTok, right?
Right. The Financial Times cited a U.S. official who said that she raised it, and then John Kirby of the NSC confirmed that it was discussed. I haven't seen any additional details on the substance of the exchange on that front, but interesting nonetheless. And the U.S. side, the White House readout said Biden emphasized the importance of maintaining peace and stability across the Taiwan Strait and the rule of law and freedom of navigation in the South China Sea. And then he also raised concerns over the PRC's support for Russia's defense industrial base and its impact on European and transatlantic security. And that just goes to your point. Consuming the readouts, it sounded like two completely different calls.
Yeah.
But it is, you know, a legitimate concern that the American side has in terms of what China has done over the last 2 years to make Russia's war in Ukraine possible.
No, that's right. And also that specific language, the concerns, raised concerns over the PRC support for Russia's defense industrial base. That is a language that you've seen from Blinken. I think you've seen from the National Security Advisor Sullivan's readout in his recent meeting with Wang Yi. And it really what it is the U.S. side, from my understanding, the Chinese side is still not actually delivering lethal weapons, but they're delivering all sorts of stuff that makes the Russians build those lethal weapons.
Right, and, like components, correct?
And the U.S. side is getting increasingly concerned about what is being supplied.
Yeah, exactly. And there's not necessarily any lever that the U.S. can pull to crack down on that behavior. But I think it's notable that the U.S. is continuing to express frustration.
And the Chinese are continuing to just sort of, you know, give the U.S. the hand.
Right. But it's a credible answer on the American side to the concerns over sanctions on the tech sector and the tariffs and everything else. It's like, well, stop supporting Russia. And it's just, again, there's just so much tit for tat in any of these conversations.
But again, she's not going to stop supporting Putin. It's like the sun's going to stop rising in the east. It's not going to happen.
Right.
So, you know, again, it's good they talked. You know, she's been very busy. He's been meeting with lots of foreign leaders. He's going to France, I think, in the next month or so. Germany Schultz is coming to, Chancellor Schultz is going to China, I think, in the next few weeks.
Mm-hmm.
Again, this, I think part of this context for this call is sort of how it gets presented to other foreign constituencies as sort of, look, I'm trying to manage it and the US is being unreasonable, or look, I'm trying to manage it and the Chinese are not, you know, listening on the Philippines or listening on Taiwan or South China Sea.
Right. Yeah.
So that kind of posturing is part of it.
Well, and then, of course, you mentioned earlier, Janet Yellen is visiting China this week, and the Wall Street Journal had a write-up on her visit, in advance of the visit, that is. As Janet Yellen prepares to travel to China this week as President Biden's Treasury Secretary, a cascade of inexpensive Chinese clean energy goods is driving down prices on global markets, threatening to snuff out American efforts to nurture a domestic clean energy industry. In meetings in Guangzhou and Beijing, Yellen is expected to tell her Chinese counterparts to stop relying on exports to prop up their underperforming economy and instead boost their own consumer market. The warning, I wonder whether she'll use those words. The warning from Yellen is a sign that the Biden administration is moving toward raising Trump-era tariffs on some Chinese products, including electric vehicles. Such a move could reignite tensions between the world's two largest economies, which have tried to stabilize relations in recent months. So does that align with what you're hearing about the potential for the Biden administration to raise tariffs in the next couple months?
So the Trump-era tariffs, there's a review coming up. There's been talk about certainly not pulling back on tariffs, but maybe increasing some, especially around autos. And so I think there's very little reason to believe that the Biden administration is going to move off of what Trump did. And in some ways, they may adjust the mix a little bit and probably will add to it.
Okay. Interesting.
And I mean, you look at just from both what's happening with China and China's economy and exports, but also it's an election year in the U.S. Look at what he's doing with Nippon Steel, you know, allied Japan's attempted acquisition of U.S. Steel.
U.S. Steel, yeah.
I mean, it's just the politics are not, it's not a good time to be looking weak on tariffs.
And so how does that fit into the broader story with Yellen and U.S.-China policy?
Well, I think the fundamental problem is that the PRC political economy is not one that can make that shift to pull away from exports, go to domestic consumption, and sort of stop relying on foreign markets. It's something that foreign officials and academics have been suggesting for many, many years. Chinese academics have been suggesting for many, many years. The party just doesn't think that makes sense. And if you look at what, maybe very simplistic, but when you look at things like the way she has actually put even more focus on the state-owned enterprises, the big state-owned enterprises, you know, it's going in the other direction in a lot of ways. And So some sort of a collision feels like it's increasingly inevitable between the EU and China, the US and China, and even, you know, other countries where, as the Chinese economy is relatively weak and domestic consumer demand has been relatively weak, you know, the old days, the Chinese could export their way out of these crises, but they were exporting a lot of lower end stuff. Now They've moved up the value chain where they're starting to export things like automobiles, which are, you know, countries in the EU that have big auto industries, the US big auto industry, they're just not going to allow their auto industries to be hollowed out by cheaper Chinese cars.
Sure.
It's not going to happen.
Well, and it creates a dependence that then becomes a national security vulnerability.
Well, but it also just from a domestic perspective, it's just not something that any person who needs to be elected can deal with, is losing, you know, large swaths of your industrial heartland.
Yeah.
Right. And so there is, it feels increasingly like there's just a real inevitability where the Chinese side appear intransigent. Their view, and yesterday I quoted, you know, I think it's a good encapsulation of the Chinese view, and some people argue it's completely reasonable, is, you know, there's a Xinhua commentary that basically is titled "The Hidden Agenda Behind Hype of China's Overcapacity Problem." Mm-hmm. And it basically said this new variant of China threat theory is just a pretext for certain Western countries to poison the environment for China's domestic development and international cooperation and take more protectionist measures for their own industries. They said, you know, because it's just basic economics that surplus products naturally seek out markets elsewhere once domestic demand is met. And right. Western nations have been doing that for centuries. But when China does it, it becomes an overcapacity problem. I just think that you're sort of, again, they're like talking past each other. And one of the problems is if you look at the PRC political economy, the shift away from this model, you know, if it were easy, they would have done it. Experts have been advising this for many, 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 many years, and it just isn't really happening.
I mean, I read an article advising it every other day at this point.
I know. I just ignore them now because, you know, it's, again, probably too jaded. And, you know, when you look at the focus, the increased focus on moving up the value chain, Chinese modernization is building this modern industrial system. The problem, in some ways, when the Chinese are exporting shoes and t-shirts, no one cares that much if there is overcapacity. But when they're up the value chain and into these, you know, high-tech goods, auto industry, then it becomes much more politically sensitive. And, you know, you have domestic constituents who are much more powerful and making much more money who are obviously going to push back. And so there sort of feels like there is no easy solution here, because on the Chinese side, they have too much capacity in a lot of these industries, you know, and a lot of these industries like the auto industry, solar panels, you know, they were built through planning and subsidies. And then, you know what? Then the Chinese companies, always the best entrepreneurs, rise to the top and they build these world-beating companies that are world-class and super low cost and really good quality and are actually more competitive than the foreign companies.
Right.
You know, yeah. once they sort of graduate out through the kind of mosh pit of industrial policies where it's a bit of a free-for-all, and then, you know, the fittest survive. I mean, sometimes the best connected survive, but ultimately it's the ones who are really the fittest and the best entrepreneurs who rise to the top.
Yeah, well, and on the American side, if you're Janet Yellen or part of her team in these meetings this week, you say, okay, well, you continue to funnel state money into exports despite seeing clearly that there's a surplus in all these different industries, and you're continuing to throw all your weight in this direction rather than try to stimulate domestic demand and fix your economy that way. So on our side, we have no choice but to react to that behavior and protect our domestic industries that are important.
And this interview that Secretary Yellen gave to the Wall Street Journal today, or yes, you know, that's published today on the eve of her trip, is interesting because, you know, the Chinese have always seen the Yellen as really among the most dovish of the cabinet secretaries.
She's been a friendly voice, yeah.
And if they've lost Yellen on this issue, then that's a sign of probably some more troubles ahead in the relationship. I mean, but it's also this, you know, she has this quote that says, people like me grew up with the view, if people send you cheap goods, you send them a thank you note. That's what standard economics basically says.
Mm-hmm.
I would never again say send the thank you note, right? It's sort of, you in this interview, she's trying to say that she's questioning a lot of her fundamental assumptions about trade.
Yeah, well, and I
which
think
is,
that's
which
true
is what's
for...
been going on all over the place now.
Right.
And so I think we're actually, this process is in many ways only just beginning.
Yeah, well, and it's not a unique insight. It's central to what the journal was writing about this week. But Yellen is an interesting figure because she was central to the Clinton administration's approach to China and the accession to the WTO and the shift and evolution in the way she understands this landscape over the last 25 years reflects a shift that is seen throughout the U.S. government and indeed throughout the world in terms of the way China's rise in exports is being understood and the policies that are being crafted in response. So speaking of policies crafted in response, the final question here, what could China do to respond to rising tariffs to the extent that this is seen as something of an existential concern, short of any sort of military armed conflict type response? But are there economic levers that China might try to pull? Or is it simply a matter of redirecting goods to countries that don't have tariffs?
It'll be a mixture of things, including that last bit. I think also you'll see them try and do more WTO cases. They have extremely competent WTO sort of
advocates,
experts and lawyers and experts who are trained by American trade lawyers.
Great.
including one, the father of one of my high school friends was a well-known trade lawyer in D.C. I think his last job was at Akin Gump. And for many years, he would train groups of Chinese in trade negotiation and how in trade law.
Okay.
Global trade law.
Well, good. Put those skills to use.
And he was a very, very, very good trade lawyer. So
China is very good at working the refs with both the UN and the WTO. They're
honestly, all joking aside, I think they recently brought a case. I should know off the top of my head. I think you'll see more of that. I think ultimately, though, we're really at risk of just breaking the WTO. I mean, it's already pretty fragile, you know, between China, the Trump administration. I mean, there are a lot of challenges to the WTO, and I wouldn't be surprised if I think there's a reasonable chance it doesn't really survive the next few years.
Mm-hmm.
Because it's just fundamentally, China is moving too quickly on so many industries that big countries think are important.
Well, and these differences are intractable.
Right. And Xi's whole vision is, you know, moving up the value chain as they should, right? I mean, this is like, I mean, you can't fault the Chinese for wanting to move up the value chain and wanting to dominate in high-tech industries and dominate in car manufacturing.
Yeah.
The problem is, you know, other countries don't want to deal with or aren't willing to accept the dislocation that's coming.
Yeah.
And so that's, I think, where you have a real fundamental clash on other things they can do. Certainly, you know, countries with companies that have a lot of interests in China, you know, they can be used as leverage so that you can threaten coercion. I mean, one thing you're seeing on the EU side is reports that, you know, the German auto manufacturers are against any sort of like an investigation into subsidies around Chinese EVs because they know that they're very lucrative cash flow businesses, auto businesses in China are at risk of retaliation.
Mm-hmm. Well, yeah, we'll see. The prospect of economic war is not encouraging.
No. But I mean, the thing is, you know, you go away for a week, you think about, I mean, if you sort of look at different scenarios about how things play out over the next few years, I mean, you can craft pretty dark, you know, when you look at sort of this increasing economic confrontation, not just competition, but confrontation and fracturing on top of what's happening in Europe with Russia and Ukraine and the tensions around the Philippines and Taiwan. I mean, you know, you can certainly see echoes of a previous era that, you know, got pretty bad for the world.
No, exactly. And with the U.S. and China specifically, economic interdependence has traditionally been a pretty powerful bulwark against tension and or conflict. And as that dissipates, then I'm not sure where that leaves both countries and the rest of the world. But let me tell you, Bill, economic interdependence is not dead yet. And so I wanted to move to Xi's meeting with U.S. business leaders.
Xi is in you and you are in Xi?
Yeah, exactly. I'm not
sorry,
sure.
We will get to that sentence and you'll understand what I mean. But it is a strange sounding sentence in English is all I'll say.
Okay, good to know. There was also a Politburo meeting on Friday last week. Again, there was no announcements of plans for the mythical third plenum that may or may not, or plenum, excuse
plenum,
me,
plenum.
Oh my God, we went over this a couple weeks ago. Apologies to any listeners that may have triggered. There was no announcement of a third plenum that may or may not deliver news of any sort of structural reforms being planned by the party. Did you have any thoughts on that development, or should we move to Xi and the foreign business community?
I mean, again, what I wrote on Monday was basically like, I mean, the plenum was, the topic was around the second round of disciplinary inspections. Every party Congress, they'll go investigate these rounds where they'll pick 20 or 30 organizations and inspect them. And so this was to review the reports on what problems they found in terms of corruption and lax party discipline and inadequate, like ideological, I don't want to say fervor, but a sort of inadequate ideological work.
Okay.
But so again, this was this Politburo meeting, and you know, every month they have them every month. They may have them more than once a month, but they publicize usually once a month at the end of the month, but not everyone gets publicized in the Xi era. And you know, every time people hope, well, maybe let's just think about the economy. This was nothing about the economy other than, sort of, again, talking about the importance of the big state-owned enterprises. And so I think for folks who are looking for more signals that, you know, maybe there'll be more, you know, more stimulus or other kind of economic changes, again, sort of what we were talking about earlier about, you know, this switch become more consumer-focused, which, you know, has been the mantra from experts for decades, and it's really happening.
Mm-hmm.
None of that was there. This was a political meeting about political issues around discipline, ideology, corruption, et cetera. And there was no mention of the plenum. And so we don't know. I mean, my guess is it'll be this fall. There's no reason it needs to be held anytime soon. And I also think, you know, there's other people, some people are saying, well, the third plenum, it'll be about economic issues. There's no hard and fast rule that says that's the case. Maybe it will be, maybe it won't. And so I think folks who are hoping for the plenum to somehow change the course on the Chinese economic policies or sort of give more hope that there'll be more stimulative or more reforms that will bring some breakthroughs in the economy, I think that's probably, at this point, a waste of bandwidth.
Okay. Yes. Well, I can't wait until the third plenum is finally announced. There's just going to be a rapturous emergency episode of Sharp China.
Yes, we'll have it. Yeah. But the one interesting thing was usually when they have a polypeer, their monthly polypeer meeting, then right after they have a polypeer study session on
this time.
They'll usually bring in an expert. They talk about it. And this time there was no publicized study session, which again, you know, two things. One, maybe they didn't have one, or maybe they had it on something, a topic that was sensitive that they didn't want to publicize.
Okay.
And we don't know, right? And there's been nothing, haven't seen any talk about whether or not the one was held, and we may never know, or maybe it'll come out if, you know, somebody will publish something or a comment she made at the polypeer study session in March 2024. Will show up in some collected work of his speeches in like 2026. Yeah.
We'll update everyone in 2027.
No, but that's one of the reasons why these books that come out are actually useful, because they often will publish things that haven't been published before.
No, absolutely. And you'll see speeches that are published, you know, 18 months down the line. Yeah. And so we'll see. Unfortunately, for a podcast that follows China policy, opacity continues to be the baseline for the Xi regime. Yes.
We should change it to Blurry China, I think, is the
not all that sharp sometimes. All right. So from NBC News, Chinese President Xi Jinping met with top U.S. executives in Beijing on Wednesday. This is last Wednesday, as his government tries to reassure foreign businesses about a market that remains crucial for their bottom lines, despite persistent tensions between the world's two biggest economies. She met the group of American business people and academics at the Great Hall of the People, Chinese state media reported. The meeting was preceded by a group photo. Participants included Blackstone founder Steven Schwarzman, Bloomberg chair Mark Carney, FedEx president Rajesh Subramaniam, and Qualcomm president and CEO Cristiano Amon, according to state media reports. During the meeting, she said the Chinese economy was healthy and sustainable, an achievement that, quote, cannot be separated from international cooperation, according to state media, which reported that he listened carefully to the American participants. The executives were in China for a series of business-related events, including the China Development Forum, an annual high-level meeting that ended Monday. And she also told business leaders that tensions between the U.S. and China stemmed from incorrect perceptions of Beijing's intentions, according to Xinhua. Was there anything that you found notable about the way that meeting was handled and messaged in the aftermath?
Well, so it was arranged by the two of the groups that arranged the Xi dinner in San Francisco to meet with business executives, the National Council on U.S.-China Relations and the China Business Council. And this time, I don't think you had to pay $40,000 to meet Xi like you did in San Francisco. I think this was they knew that a lot of these CEOs were going to be in town for the China Development Forum. So they were able to set up this meeting. Xi, of course, the CDF, the China Development Forum, I think ended on Sunday. And then the ones who wanted to attend the meeting with Xi had to basically find something else to do in China for 2.5 days.
Just hang out.
Wait around for their audience, which I know turned off some of the potential attendees because they're pretty busy people. It's interesting. Tim Cook was in China for a few days before CDF. They opened the big Shanghai flagship store, went to basically with CDF, and then he didn't stick around for the meeting with Xi. Ken Griffin of Citadel was in there for the CDF. He left, but one of his guys went to the meeting with Xi. I mean, I think the meeting was, you know, my understanding was, you know, there was nothing particularly, like, no one came out of that meeting thinking like, oh my God, this is, you know, things have changed, or, you know, it was a reiteration of a lot of what Xi tried to present in San Francisco. Continued talk of, you know, we welcome foreign businesses, we're going to keep reforming. I think ultimately, for the folks who attended, it probably helps their businesses in China.
Right.
But ultimately, does it move the needle? Does it assuage a lot of the concerns that foreign businesses have about both the state of the economy and the state of the political situation and the state of the U.S.-China relationship? Probably not. You know, honestly, the most interesting thing out of the entire meeting was it's just increasingly obvious that, you know, Henry Kissinger is gone. There's always the hope that there'll sort of be a Henry Kissinger 2.0. And I think from the Chinese side, they've settled on the best available replacement for Henry Kissinger is Graham Allison of Harvard University and Thucydides Trap fame.
Right. Yes.
Who has just been feted like a rock star on the Chinese side. And he's always been he's been welcomed there for several years. But I think this last trip, he sort of raised it up a level in terms of the access he got and the kind of the sort of the way that, you know, the Chinese side was pushing him and his idea of the Thucydides Trap and how to avoid conflict as sort of really kind of pushing him to the next level in terms of strategic thinking status.
Yeah, no, exactly. And for anyone who's unfamiliar, the Thucydides trap is a reference to the Peloponnesian War, I believe, and it describes a tendency towards war when a rising power challenges the status of a ruling power. So obvious parallels to China and the U.S., depending on your perspective. I, too, would like to avoid the Thucydides trap for the sake of the modern world. But yeah, as far as Graham Allison,
I will say that the Greek scholars are generally quite skeptical of this creation. But Allison has, you wrote a book about it. The Chinese love it because it's all about how the U.S. needs to accommodate China.
Yeah,
is what it comes down to. So from their perspective, this is super useful.
I was going to say it aligns pretty closely with the way the party feels about the U.S. responsibility to avoid conflict. But that was the other thing I had on the rundown. It is mainly because a few weeks ago you were talking about the Global Times and you had some crack about how when they're channeling state messaging, they'll go to their rent a think tanker program to help interpret party logic. And so the Global Times, in the wake of this meeting with Xi and American business leaders and Graham Allison, they write, occasionally human beings are born inseparable, conjoined Siamese twins. There are two heads, but they have the same nervous or gastrointestinal system. If either of them were to strangle the other, they commit suicide. This is how Graham Allison describes U.S.-China relations in an exclusive interview with the Global Times. During his recent trip to Beijing, Allison, Douglas Dillon Professor of Government at Harvard University, met with a series of government officials and scholars and attended President Xi Jinping's meeting with representatives from the U.S. business, strategic, and academic communities on March 27th. So just putting it down as a marker, as you said, it certainly appears Graham Allison is a contender to succeed Henry Kissinger as the lead in terms of people-to-people exchanges. And he's also now the top option when PRC authorities want to rent a U.S. think tanker. So,
well, he's a Harvard professor but yeah, he is really, I think, now at sort of the pinnacle of U.S. experts that the Chinese side want to talk to and try and talk through. And I think, you know, he has, as he said, he has a lot of former students who are in the Biden administration sprinkled around D.C. He has a lot of access. I was at a forum earlier this year and sitting at a table with him. He had to leave early because he was off to a lunch with a very, very senior U.S. administration official. And so, I mean, he has a lot of access on both sides. It's a very interesting dynamic. But it is, I think, also worth noting how the Chinese side really seems to have, he's sort of leveling up is kind of how I look at it. And to the joke I made at the beginning of this segment where we talked about I am in you and you are in me. Mm-hmm. So Graham Allison, he has a long Twitter thread we'll put in the show notes to sort of go through this meeting with Xi Jinping. And he was given a chance to speak for 5 minutes. And he says in one of his tweets, he says, you know, she went on to use an interesting metaphor to describe the U.S.-China relationship. I am in you and you are in me. And I guess, you know, the idea is it's just sort of inseparable, intertwined. Right.
Conjoined twins, I guess.
Yeah, I guess. So that's where that came from. I do think in one of the comments I had about when I wrote about this meeting, I wrote about it on Monday because I was on vacation last week, is I think, you know, the Chinese side, they're always looking for the folks who can back channel the DC.
Right.
Right. It was Kissinger. It's other people. They're always looking for the friendly interlocutors. And I think, you know, the Americans who attend this meeting, they are very sophisticated people. They understand this. They're not rubes. Right. Mm-hmm. But I really think that given the politics in DC, you know, if, as I'm assuming, the PRC is hoping to use this group of people as sort of vectors or vehicles to send messages into D.C. and shape or at least sort of push to tweak policies, I think they're overestimating the influence of these people in D.C.
Yes, and overestimated Kissinger's influence over the last many years.
And I think it's the sort of they always have to find the other way around to sort of because, you know, they're not getting what they want from the officials from the Biden administration. So they need to, you know, to find the other pressure points to influence policy, get people to change their minds. I don't think this group is going to actually be that successful at that, if that's what if that's what the Chinese side thinks they want, is trying to get them to do.
Yeah. Well, this just reminds me of the hero's welcome for Gavin Newsom 5 or 6 months ago. One of the highlights of the Sharp China podcasting. And yeah, Graham Allison, I'm less immersed in the space than you are, obviously. So I'm mostly familiar with Graham Allison because some of his analysis of the Chinese economy and the U.S. economy and the relative strengths on both sides will be cited by people on Twitter. And it just doesn't really align with the realities that I've become familiar with just reading about the developments of both countries. And so he certainly has a distinct perspective, but I'm a little skeptical of where he's coming from on some of this stuff. But clearly, Beijing is not. And so I expect we'll hear more of him.
I mean, the Global Times interview, and we'll put a link into it. The Global Times interview, I think, was, you know, this meeting happened a couple days after the latest confrontation over Second Thomas Shoal between the Philippines and the PRC, where the Chinese Coast Guard with the water cannons did even more damage to a very small wooden Philippines boat.
Yep.
And, you know, over the ensuing few days, there's lots of, you know, accusations on both sides and lots of rhetorical escalation. And, you know, in this interview with Global Times, when he was asked about the Philippines, you know, his response was, in the case of the Philippines and the Shoal, I'm not well informed about that. That's a cop out.
Yeah.
Right. I mean, Philippines is a treaty ally of the U.S. If you're doing like strategic studies, strategic thinker, and you don't understand, and you're an American at an American university, you can't. That is not a credible answer.
Right.
Right.
Now, not from him.
It's possible he said something else, and this is what the Global Times put in there because they didn't like what he said. My advice to anybody, if any of you on this podcast, listening to this podcast, if any of you ever get interviewed by, frankly, any media, but especially PRC media, as a condition, make it you get to record the entire interview and then you transcribe it yourself.
Ah, okay. Well, I'll keep that in mind before the Global Times Sharp China profile.
Yeah, and you don't have a record of it, then you're, you know, fair game.
Well, and you mentioned the Philippines incident. We don't have to spend very much time on it, but I will say that in the wake of that incident, for anybody who didn't see the video, we'll put it in the show notes, another water cannon incident in the South China Sea where, again, as you said, the Filipino boat was badly damaged. There were injuries. It was all on video. And then there were two tweets from Hu Shijin, who's the former editor-in-chief of the Global Times. He said, as a media professional, I strongly advocate that China should not fire the first shot in various frictions. This should be upheld as China's principle of goodwill for peace in the South China Sea. But the Philippines should listen carefully. Once the Philippines fires the first shot, I fully support the PLA in making a Filipino ship riddled with bullets. I believe most Chinese people will support it by then. And then he added in a follow-up tweet, if a military conflict breaks out in the South China Sea over
the Chinese for a Second Thomas Shoal,
most of the world's public will understand that it's the result of Filipino step-by-step pushing under U.S. instigation.
Right.
China has patiently played a cat-and-mouse game with the Philippines for 25 years. No major country would be so merciful. If the Philippine Coast Guard wants to risk its neck, we'll do it a favor and turn the South China Sea into its grave. I was stunned by the language there. I mean, clearly warriorism is not dead, but I'm just worried by all of this.
No, it's bad.
And yeah,
he and his kids aren't going to be fighting if there's any sort of a conflict. It's easy to advocate for conflict. You know, the Philippines, we've talked on a couple of podcasts about Second Thomas Shoal, Rinnai Jiao, and the, you know, the Philippines had grounded this Navy vessel, the Sierra Madre. And then they actually rotate Philippine Marines through there. The ship is disintegrating. It needs to be reinforced. The Chinese have allowed for a long time, they would allow resupplies of basic supplies and rotating troops, but they don't want any construction supplies going because they know that the ship will disintegrate. And, you know, they are now claiming that the previous president, Duterte, basically promised the Chinese side that they would unground the ship. They would get rid of it because
right.
And the Philippines, the current president, well, that's not, you know, where's the contract? Well, you know, didn't happen, et cetera, et cetera. The Chinese are trying to play themselves as we were screwed. We're the victim. The Philippines are only being uppity because of the big, bad U.S. And anything bad that happens is ultimately America's fault. And we're the victim. And that, I think, shows up in a bit of what Hu Xijin was saying. And so, you know, what I think may be happening, because there was talk last fall that the ship, the Sierra Madre, was close to disintegrating, is that you've seen over the last couple months the Chinese getting much more aggressive about trying to block resupplies. It may be that they have concluded that their ship is really close to falling apart. And as soon as it does, then they can swoop in. You know, we talked about on previous podcast, they'll probably swoop in and rescue the Philippine Marines, say they're saviors, and then take over the shoal.
Yeah,
and win-win,
the principle
right?
of goodwill
win-win,
for peace,
right.
as who
know,
says. Yeah, I mean...
But all joking aside, I think that is a real possibility. And for the Philippine side, you know, they need to figure out a way to get that ship, if they want to keep it there, they have to figure out a way to get that reinforced. And the Chinese aren't going to let them. And so then it becomes a question of, do they ask the U.S. for help? My understanding is they have not yet asked the U.S. to help. If they do, what does the U.S. do?
That's the question. And for anybody who's listening to this for the first time and is a free listener, the high level dynamics here are basically that China is trying to claim territory in the South China Sea that is internationally recognized as Filipino territory. And
well, the Chinese, of course, say that's all. It's
right.
all. It's not based in international law, and it's all wrong, and it's China's territory. I mean, their position is very clear that the Philippines have no claim on this. On this area, even though it's, you know, very close to the Philippines and very far from China.
Yeah. And as the Philippines tries to maintain its claim on some of this territory and sends out these boats for resupply missions, China continues to provoke different sorts of conflicts. Lately, the tactics have involved water cannons, and the U.S. has a treaty with the Philippines by which the U.S. is required to intervene and defend the Philippines. The specific language I don't have in front of me right now, but if there's an armed conflict, the U.S. is supposed to get involved on the Filipino behalf. And water cannons thus far have not risen to armed conflict in the eyes of either the Philippines or the U.S. government.
Well,
but,
I'll give you the exact language, because actually the on Monday, so just a few hours or 12 hours before the Xi Biden call, U.S. National Security Advisor Sullivan had a call with the Filipino National Security Advisor. And the readout from the U.S. side said that Mr. Sullivan, quote, underscored the ironclad U.S. alliance commitments to the Philippines under the U.S.-Philippines Mutual Defense Treaty, which extends to armed attacks on Philippine armed forces, public vessels, or aircraft, to include those of its Coast Guard anywhere in the South China Sea. Now, armed attack is what is the definition of armed attack? Is a water cannon that destroys a boat or injures, you know, ultimately leads to, say, a boat being destroyed and someone drowning? Is that an armed attack or not? And I think that's where there's a lot of leeway from the U.S. side. Is water a weapon?
And I'll tell you what, watch the video. It sure looks like a weapon.
Look at the Grand Canyon. Water looks pretty powerful to me.
Yeah, exactly. And so I don't mean to laugh, but the realities in play in the South China Sea right now.
Very, very dangerous. Very, very, very dangerous. And the Philippines, this particular flashpoint is, again, we talked about this a few times and I've said it before. It feels like, how much longer can sort of this keep it in this very friction-filled and fraught state
gray
before
area.
There is some sort of a confrontation?
Yeah.
And I think with specifically for this, the Sierra Madre is... I think that thing has a time limit on it because it is disintegrating.
Well, it's all pretty ominous. And I'm increasingly worried that before there's any sort of conflict in Taiwan, there's going to be some sort of forcing function that emerges in the South China Sea that demands U.S. intervention and takes the U.S.-China dynamics to a really ugly place. So we'll knock on wood that that doesn't happen.
And my understanding is this: it was raised by the U.S. side in the call, and that the U.S. side was pretty adamant that they're going to support the Philippines.
Okay, well,
ultimately, it's really China's choice, I think, whether or not they want to keep pushing this to something closer to some sort of a confrontation over the shoal.
So in lighter news, to close out the show here, I want to talk about Tesla and three body problem. Elon Musk and Tesla... not doing great right now, globally not doing great, but particularly in China, the problems look pretty acute. What do you think of what was reported this week? The Tesla stock price is taking a hit. Tesla is now offering zero interest financing on the 3 and Y.
Well, so yeah, so Tesla, I mean, I think we again, it's something we talked about before. I did a podcast on cynicism last year where we talked about Tesla's coming problems in China. And I think, you know, Tesla's an amazing company. They have built an amazing factory in China. They got a ton of market share as a foreign company. They've been incredibly successful in China. The problem is they spurred all sorts of Chinese rivals to up their game. And mm-hmm. now you have all these Chinese car manufacturers who are as good or better, understand the Chinese market better, are also extremely low cost, and are continually coming out with new and innovative models. And Tesla's models are several years old, and there are no plans for any new models in the near future. So Tesla now has sort of an aging, boring line in China, while you have all these really good entrepreneurial Chinese car companies, the latest being Xiaomi, the phone maker, who just came out with a car, the SU7, last week that already has something like 50,000 non-refundable orders for it.
It really puts Apple to shame after years. I
mean, looks like the Taycan. Looks a lot like a Porsche, but that's fine. No one cares in China. And, you know, it's just like they've got buzz, they've got hype, they got a fresh vehicle. Tesla is now behind in China in a lot of ways. They still sell a lot of cars. The only thing is they announced, I think last week or 2 weeks ago, they're going to raise prices at the start of Q2, April 1st. But right as Q2 started, all the whole bunch of the Chinese companies cut prices.
Yeah.
Right. And so Tesla's going the wrong direction, which is why they announced today this what you just read, basically this zero interest financing on the Model 3 and the Model Y.
So not cutting prices, but making it much easier to buy a Tesla in China.
So you can drive one home with a down payment of renminbi $79,900 with no interest for 36 months. Or if you trade in a vehicle, 60 months with no interest.
Yeah, I should buy my next car.
So they're not cutting the price, but obviously they're subsidizing other ways because they realize that they're raising prices in the face of really good Chinese competition. Cutting prices with newer, fresher models or better lineups, you know, was untenable for them. And so one of the questions, and this is ultimately, you know, when you go to sort of, you know, Tesla in China, one of the questions I think for investors is this a momentary blip or has Tesla peaked in China? And my personal view is Tesla has peaked.
Yeah.
Because, you know, they did so well in the market when they were way ahead of everybody else. They are no longer ahead.
Yes. Well,
in fact, they're behind in many ways.
And Tesla, I don't want to make too many jokes at Tesla's expense because Tesla is an incredible success story that has pushed EV technology forward all over the world. B, it seems like every 18 months, there's this sort of Tesla crisis where everyone sort of proclaims that the downfall is imminent. And then Tesla has managed to evolve and continue
and
thrive. Yeah, exactly. So putting that conversation aside, I will say, according to Bloomberg, Tesla delivered 386,000 vehicles in the first 3 months of the year, missing Bloomberg's average estimate by the biggest margin ever in data going back 7 years. And they have an analyst who says it's been an epic disaster, not just in terms of the delivery number, but the strategy. That being said, and of course, it's seen most clearly in China, where the market is pretty robust and competitive. What interested me is you could obviously make the case that Tesla is sort of a unique story because of the PRC EV explosion and the way it sort of created a tidal wave of competition for Tesla that happened seemingly overnight. But what I wonder is to what extent are Tesla's issues emblematic of a larger trend that will afflict basically every public American tech company that does a large portion of its business in China? Like, there are more traditional consumer companies like Nike or McDonald's that will be, I'm sure, fine over the next decade that have large presences in China. But whether it's Tesla or chip companies or
Apple.
Ben and I have talked a lot about Apple in recent weeks. I mean, Apple has a huge dependency and their sales are declining in China also. And so I think part of the decoupling narrative and trends that we're seeing is going to really eat into business that has served these companies really, really well over the last 10 to 15 years. Yeah. And it's going to be seen in the stock prices of all these companies.
I mean, Apple, I think I would say, is a bit different than Tesla in China. One, I mean, one, their phones are still better than the Chinese competition. I mean, they're better phones. They're also a lot more expensive. They're price premium. You know, Tesla's trying to not be the most expensive cars in the market, right? And so Tesla's, I think, in many ways, again, because they have been so slow refreshing their models, they have been caught standing by really good Chinese competitors like Xiaomi, like BYD, especially BYD.
Yeah.
And companies that understand the market better are able to build cars that better fit the Chinese consumer taste and are able to build cars at multiple price points to fit the dynamics of the market. And so I think that if the economy were to start recovering and people were maybe wanted more confidence, came back, spending more money, Apple may see a lift in sales. Tesla, I think, just has more structural headwinds for it in China.
Right. Well, and Tesla was operating as the clear industry leader all over the world for a long time.
Because they were.
But as more competition emerges, of course, the picture is going to get more complicated for them moving forward.
So I just think if, like, you know, people get, it's kind of funny to watch some of the wars over Twitter, and people get really nuts and quite emotional over Twitter. I don't have any position in the stock, and, you know, I don't really care. I would just say that if you think China is important to Tesla, you really need to dig in and understand why this is a...
The outlook sort of is not great.
A cyclical issue for Tesla versus a sort of a longer-term structural issue for Tesla in China. And like I said, I tend to fall towards more on the, it's peaked and there are so many problems and so many structural issues that it seems unlikely that Tesla is ever going to recover what it had in China. And like Cybertruck, you know, the thing about Cybertruck is I think they did a little tour of Cybertruck. That thing, you know, from reports online, it has a lot of fit and finish issues, quality issues. They can't sell that in China if it's got those kind of issues.
Mm-hmm.
Chinese consumers on a mass scale, they're not going to take it. Maybe we'll get a few collectors, but it's not going to move the needle, I don't think.
Right. Well, yeah. And the gap between Apple and some of the PRC phones is not as big as it once was. And Apple's had to cut prices to try to compete. And so I just think across a lot of these sectors, it's going to get pretty thorny in the years to come here.
Apple, the other issue for Apple is, again, and Tesla has this a bit too, but it's the national security where...
Right. Is it a security risk? It sort of casts aspersions on it.
Well, not only that, but certain government officials, families of, you know, family members of government officials or SOE workers, you know, certain institutions, you're basically told don't have Apple products, don't have Tesla products.
Yeah.
And that could spread. We'll see.
Yes. Well, one final question here. David says, I was curious if the depiction of the Cultural Revolution at the start of Three Body Problem is considered uncontroversial within China, or if it would be any different if released today. The book is quite harsh on that time in China's history, and the helplessness of the main characters is really the driving force behind their initial response to first contact. I thought it was a great start to the book, but would be interested to understand how it's read within China, or if the depiction is toned down at all in the new Tencent series on the book and its sequels. And obviously, Netflix has a Western version of Three Body Problem that debuted in late March. Bill, do you have any answer there?
Well, so the author, Liu Cixin, I mean, he put the Cultural Revolution in the middle of the book, and he said in interviews it was because he thought it would be less likely to be picked up by the censors than if he opened with it. I would recommend people watch the Tencent version. It's nicely subtitled. It's on YouTube. It's free. You know, Netflix, I actually stopped watching it after the third episode. I don't know. I wasn't.
I'm with you. I stuck it out honestly. Until the end of the season, but I lost interest, I would say, around three or four.
But I mean, specifically the opening scene, the Cultural Revolution scene. So it's kind of funny. It's generally... seems to have been pretty well done, historically accurate, except for like the font's wrong. And one of the slogans is from later years in the Cultural Revolution. So it was a little bit off.
Okay.
But for a Netflix show, I think it's a relatively high level of accuracy. So that's, you know, not bad. I would just go back to, if you really want to, you know, go to YouTube, we'll put a link to the show. It's nicely subtitled. If you're a big fan, you watch Netflix and you still like it, I would watch the 10 cent one. I think it's better done and more faithful to the original book.
So there was an essay in the LA Review of Books that said the Santi and their advanced technologies were allegories for the United States, an existential threat that could serve as a goad to innovation. And when the novels were first serialized in China in 2006, they gave expression to widespread optimism over the country's world historical economic growth. Is that how the books were popularly understood? Because that totally went over my head. Granted, I was watching the Netflix version.
I think some people, you know, ultimately, I think it's what does the author say they really stand for? It's one of those books where people can read lots of different things into it.
Mm-hmm.
But if you take that approach, then 18 years later, it looks quite prescient.
Yeah. Well, I knew it was enormously popular in China, but didn't realize that that might be part of what people were reading into the text there.
I mean, the Netflix spinoff they should do is of the company that bought the rights to the show in China, and then was working with Netflix, where one of the executives had a falling out with the CEO and poisoned him to death and was just sentenced to death, I think, the day before the Netflix show launched.
Yeah, that was unbelievably tragic and grim. I don't know if I want to watch that show, but yeah. I mean, I thought the Netflix show was like a 7 out of 10. It was fine. I'm not going to endorse the angriest criticisms we saw from state media and various factions on the Chinese internet.
Well,
but
because it's, you know, sort of makes China look bad, and the culture, you know, again, it's one of those things where, especially around like Cultural Revolution, honestly, a lot of the younger folks in state media, they don't actually really, their history is weak.
Yeah.
Because their history is basically what they're allowed to be taught.
Right.
And so a lot of them don't really fully understand the history.
Well, and a lot of Americans don't really fully understand the
history. No. And a lot of that is just incurious versus not being allowed to study it.
No, but I thought that the beginning of the show was when it was most compelling. I did think the westernized portions of the show were pretty underwhelming. There was just less character development, and sort of checked out. But the early scenes in China were genuinely captivating. So worth watching the first episode or two, and then check out the 10 cent version.
Yeah.
And, you know, to be fair to Netflix, the company that owned the IP rights had already sold a Mandarin version to Tencent and was pitching this explicitly as an international version that would be an English language product. So basically anyone who made this version of the show was going to be changing key aspects of the plot. I just thought the writing on the Netflix version wasn't that great. So your mileage may vary, though, out there in the sharp China audience.
One last thing to watch is this may be your year for your Purdue guy.
Zach Edey, that's right, 7-4. He is in the Final Four, I believe.
Do you have them to win?
I don't, and I honestly, with a heavy heart, I have to get off the Zach Edey bandwagon at this point, because NC State has DJ Burns, 6'8", 330 pounds. He is my favorite college basketball player in a really long time. And he beat the crap out of Duke. I would not have been able to handle Duke in the Final Four. And so NC State plays Purdue on Saturday night. And if you're not watching the 10 cent version of Three Body Problem, then tune in to NC State Purdue and check out DJ Burns.
One of my high school buddies went to NC State, and so he's getting a little insufferable in the sort of the group WhatsApp.
Oh, wow. I'm glad to hear he's enjoying the ride.
And he owns a bar in North Carolina. I think they're having a big party this weekend.
Good. Good for him. Well, we'll see how long it lasts for DJ Burns and or Zach Edey, but we'll update everyone next week. For now, Bill, it's great to see you, and we'll keep it rolling next week. If you're new to the show, you can subscribe to Cynicism or Stratechery. But until next week, I hope you have a great weekend. Get out there in the garden. Take advantage of all this rain, and I'll talk to you soon.
Thanks, Andrew. Thanks, everybody. Talk to you soon.